Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, and today for Lori Walsh. Well, it's April 15th, and we know what that means. It's tax day. But what do we actually know about tax policy? That's the subject of this week's Morning Macro. SDSU economics professor Joe Santos joins us this morning from the Janine Basinger studio on SDSU's campus. And you can follow along with us with his latest blog posted at schooled.blog.com. That's schooled, D-O-T, blog.com. Joe, welcome back to In the Moment. Happy tax day.
Thank you, Jackie. Happy tax day.
So today is less about personal tax advice and more a look at why tax policy is what it is today. So to start off, maybe walk us through the main purposes of tax policy.
Sure. So the reason governments raise taxes, arguably, are to achieve various objectives. So we can think of high standards of living, full employment, maybe strong economic growth, maybe strong environmental stewardship, the provision of public goods. So there's all sorts of answers to the question, why? Optimal taxation is a sort of a tax theory within macroeconomic policy that really tries to address the question, how? So once you've determined that you need these tax revenues, then the question is, how exactly do you raise the money? And that is to say, what are the sort of governing principles that are going to determine the mechanisms you use, what we sometimes refer to as the tax instruments or the tools? Think of like the dials and knobs you're going to turn in order to generate those revenues. And that's what optimal taxation is really all about. That's actually a thing, believe it or not. That's the name of this economic theory that drives our thinking about how best to tax.
Yep. Optimal taxation is not an oxymoron. It's a thing.
That's a thing.
So what kind of, in the blog you run through kind of the maybe three pillars of taxation. Mm-hmm. Walk us through those and how they
Sure.
work together.
Yeah, it's a great question. Great place to start. So broadly speaking, we think of taxation as having sort of three functions. One is what we call stabilization. And we talked a bit about this in our inaugural episode on fiscal therapy. And that is to say, if the reason you're raising or lowering taxes is to bring about changes in the business cycle. So you're trying to fix, if you will, a recession. You're trying to lower unemployment. You can imagine tax policy that looks to stabilize that economy by, let's say, lowering taxes and maybe stimulating aggregate spending or what have you. So that's stabilization. And that's a very particular kind of tax policy. It's the one we probably think about most when the economy is in a business cycle recession and we're throwing around ideas as to how to get the economy out. The other two, though, are probably less talked about by everybody except macroeconomists who really obsess over them. And that is the allocation function and the redistribution function. So very quickly, allocation meaning how best to allocate, think labor and capital and land and technology. These are the resources that we use to create economic growth. And allocation really refers to how we assign those resources to their best purposes. And by the way, this is not a government thing necessarily. The private market does this every day, determining how much labor to use or how many other inputs to use in the production process. Well, we can use tax policy, we think, to try to drive that allocative efficiency, that best use of our resources. And tax policy may be able to be a way to get that to happen. And so that's allocative efficiency. That's another function. And then finally is this redistribution. It sort of explains itself. This idea that you're going to take now existing income or existing wealth, which we can think of as just accumulated income, and you're going to reassign it. So you're going to take it from Peter and you're going to give it to Paul. And that's redistribution. And that's another important function of tax policy. Presumably, if you're engaging in redistributive tax policy, you've determined as the policymaker that the current distribution of income and wealth is not sufficiently equitable. And so you're going to go about the business of changing it. So again, macroeconomists, when we're not dealing with a recession, typically think of this tension, if you will, between allocative policy, think efficiency, and redistributive policy, think equity. And it's really that tension that drives this area of macroeconomic policy called optimal taxation.
Sure. And we hear a lot about maybe moral or ethical conversations about that kind of wealth redistribution. And certainly nothing exists in a vacuum, but if you could describe it from a purely economic standpoint, why does an eye towards equity make for good tax policy?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. So here's the idea, and maybe the way to explain this is to go sort of indirectly to it by starting with this allocative function. So here's the way economists think about this. If you have a market that is already achieving allocative efficiency, and you've decided, for reasons we discussed at the opener, that you need tax revenue, allocative efficiency dictates that the way you do this is you tax what we refer to as immobile tax bases. In other words, you tax what can't avoid the tax. And by doing that, you leave unaltered the allocation of resources in the economy. So, for example, if you know that someone is going to supply their labor regardless of the tax, well, that's the person you want to tax because they're going to continue to supply, allocate the same amount of labor they would have without the tax. So this is something we call a Ramsey rule. And again, you tax what essentially is not going to change as a result of the tax. And so you leave the economy unaffected. Well, if you think about this for a moment, you know, loosely, this means you tax necessities. So, you know, you tax food prices, you tax labor income, particularly relatively low labor income. Those folks tend to be the most immobile. And so the allocation process is going to be unchanged. But of course, as I'm saying this, I'm sure all listeners are thinking, but what about equity in that case? Mm-hmm. The burdens of the tax are going to fall disproportionately on those who, you know, in some sense cannot afford it. And so this is the sort of the challenge, the economic challenge, but as you say, also the sort of moral challenge, knowing the way allocative efficiency works and what taxes must do in order to preserve allocative efficiency really goes against our notions of equity. And so this is where redistribution comes in. Again, taking from Peter and giving to Paul. But of course, if Peter is making decisions at the margin based on Peter's income and so on, and you tax Peter and he then engages in some other kind of activity, that's not going to be allocatively efficient. So again, there's the tension.
Mm-hmm. And I'm working maybe a little backwards into this question now, but when we're talking about allocative efficiency, how do we? I guess my real question is, how do we know when we're there? what does that actually look like?
Yeah, well, that is a very big question. So when I began this discussion about allocative efficiency, right, I said, you know, imagine a situation where economic outcomes left to their sort of private devices in the absence of government were optimal. Well, then government stepping in is really going to disrupt this process unless you follow this so-called Ramsey rule. The reality, of course, is that there's a differing opinion, to say the least, as to whether unfettered market economies achieve socially optimal outcomes on their own. And so some folks listen to all of this, probably those screaming at their radio right now and thinking, well, some taxes are corrective. And corrective taxation, again, in theory, as you rightly kept me in the vacuum before, and I'll stay there now. In theory, corrective taxation would be taxation, as the name suggests, that attempts to correct some sort of market failure. So if you see the world as one in which private outcomes are not optimal, then the introduction of government, very disruptive, by the way, deliberately disruptive, is actually optimal because you want to stop pollution or you want to stop teenage smoking or whatever the case may be. So now that disruptive force becomes a force for good. You very much want to change the allocation decisions and the purchasing decisions of individuals. So this is the sort of fundamental challenge here, whether or not you view the private outcomes as optimal on their own, in which case you want to tax as little as possible and follow that Ramsey rule of taxing immobile bases and so on, or do you see the world as one in which market failures are prevalent, and so government in some sense completes this world by introducing taxes that deliberately distort in ways that benefit individuals. So it's sort of a bit of a more sort of paternalistic view of tax policy. And so, yeah, you really got to the nerve on that one.
Yeah, it sounds and this is probably a no duh statement for a lot of people listening, but there's really no such thing as value neutral taxation. Like, there will be some kind of impact beyond just the wallet at some point down the line. Is that maybe kind of a fair perspective? I know I'm a little afield of our conversation.
That's right. So in some sense, this is too simplistic, but the adage, you tax what you don't want. Mm-hmm. And so the question really becomes then a normative one that you're raising, which is what should we not want and what should we want, right? That's the sort of normative question. So one person's negative outcome that needs to be taxed in order to eliminate the outcome is another person's positive outcome that needs to be sheltered from taxes. So that's really the fundamental question behind this. And you're right, it comes down, as most policy does, to a sort of a value judgment that is then informed by strong, disciplined, well-reasoned economic theory. But but there is a value judgment there, of course.
Right. So any person curious about certain societal norms or whatever, look at your tax policy. Here you go.
That's right. That's right. If you look at a culture or a society's tax structure, you get a sense as to what sort of thinking informs that economic culture, if nothing else.
Yeah. And also in this blog, you go into in some ways a little bit of the history of tax policy and the system we see today. This comprehensive tax policy is actually a relatively recent invention. So tell us a bit how tax policy has evolved over a country's history.
Yeah. So tax policy, as we think of it today, as you said, sort of a systematic, comprehensive, is really very much a 20th century, mid-20th century phenomenon. There's a picture there on the blog that I think is pretty compelling, where if you go back to, in this case, I just went back to 1940, it's essentially a flat line that looks to align with zero. There really isn't much in the way of tax receipts collected at either the federal or the state and local level. What you see today is something quite dramatically different, where tax receipts at the federal, state, and local level sum to something close to, roughly depending on the year and so on, I think 20% of gross domestic product. That was a level that would be, entirely unheard of prior to the Second World War, certainly on a systematic basis, something that we just do, say, every April 15th. That notion, April 15th and the notion of the income tax is only as old as the 16th Amendment, which dates back to 1913. So, this is very much a sort of relatively modern phenomenon. And what we've noticed over time is that the way we tax has changed. So there's some, again, great pictures there, I think, that sort of illustrate how much of the, let's say, federal government's tax receipts are coming in from personal taxes, broadly defined, as opposed to corporate. And those shares are about 80 and 8, personal and corporate, respectively. So that tells us something, to your point earlier, if someone were to land here and wonder about how we sort of prioritize things, they could get some information from that number or those numbers. The other is the marginal tax rate on personal income. Astounding figure 5 on the blog post, where we see that in the 1960s, the marginal tax rate on personal income exceeded at times 90%. That's 90%. The counterpart of that number today is 37% with the most recent tax cut. And even before that, long before that, it had remained in the 40-ish, nothing near 90 for several decades now. Again, it's complicated, as you say. It's laced, of course, with value and politics and sort of entrenched interests and so on. But some of it goes back to this idea of allocative efficiency. There is a sort of a prevailing intellectual norm today in tax policy circles in the United States that taxing income at relatively high rates does not achieve allocative efficiency, because those individuals will essentially take actions to avoid those very high rates. And at the very least, this will lead to less economic growth than it would otherwise. Mm-hmm. A lot of interesting data to take a look at in terms of tax policy and sort of how it's reflected in corporate taxes, personal taxes, also state and local taxes. The federal government is responsible for about a half of the revenue, think $2 trillion-ish collected in the course of a year. State and local is responsible for about $1.8 trillion. So as I joke in the blog, the federal government doesn't have a monopoly on taxes.
My guest is Joe Santos, economics professor at South Dakota State University. You can follow along with the blog post at schooleddotblog.com. Joe, as we're kind of entering our final moment or so, can you just maybe wrap it up with what are the major challenges of adjusting tax policy?
Wow. Yeah.
Another big question. You have 45 seconds.
Let's just, it takes an act of Congress, literally and figuratively. So it's not easy because, as we say, there's even if it existed, the tax process existed in an economic vacuum, we would still have to negotiate these tensions between efficiency and equity. And then, as you pointed out, none of this exists in an economic vacuum. So we don't just have economists arguing with each other, which we do quite well at. But then you've got the political forces, the sort of the political economy, as we say, that's also shaping outcomes. And so at the very least, legislatively speaking, yes, it takes an act of Congress. So you can imagine all of the difficulties and tensions that that introduces.
You've been listening to this week's Morning Macro, Joe Santos. I never thought I'd have this much fun talking about tax policy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
And again, that blog is at schooled.blog.com.